This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. I've waited a long time to say this. John Perkins, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
My pleasure. Good, great to be with you, Jeremy.
I did ask you earlier before we were recording if you've been to South Africa. You said no. Have you actually been to countries near me on the continent?
I have not. It's one part of the world that I've not that I've missed, which I regret. I'd like to spend more time there. I've been in North Africa, but never south of North Africa.
It's quite different, the north and the south.
Yeah, I know. And it just never fell into my job title, I guess you'd say. You know, I really focused on, well, it was Latin America where I speak Spanish and know the culture well. And then I spent a lot of time in the Middle East and Asia. There's still time.
What is your background?
Well, how much detail do you want?
Well, we're going to create the context.
So, you know, when I graduated from business school in Boston, Massachusetts, I did not want to be drafted. I didn't believe in the Vietnam War. So I looked for ways to avoid the draft, and one of them was to join the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps sent me to South America, to Ecuador, deep into the Amazon rainforest. And I spent 3 years then in Ecuador in the Peace Corps. And then, which was an incredibly formative experience, it's where I learned, you know, I've written a lot of books about shamanism and touching the jaguar. I'm touching a jaguar right now. Look at that jaguar. Isn't that a cool jaguar? And then when I got out of the Peace Corps, I was recruited to do what I'd been trained to do in business school, which was to be an economist. And I became chief economist at this consulting firm. And really my job was an economic hitman. My job was to identify countries that had resources our corporations wanted, like oil or other minerals, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money didn't actually go to the country. The country was in debt and had to put up its resources collateral, but the money went to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country. Things like power plants and industrial parks and highways and airports, things that benefited a few wealthy families in the country as well as our corporations that made huge profits off building these projects. But the majority of the people actually suffered because money was diverted from health, education and other social services to pay off the interest on the loans. And in the end, the country typically could not pay off the principal. And so we went back in, usually under the guise of the International Monetary Fund, and said, hey, since you can't pay your debts, you know, we get the collateral. Give us your oil or whatever the resource is at cut rate prices without environmental or social regulations. Let us build a military base on your soil. Vote with us on the next United Nations vote against Cuba or China or whatever. And in that way, we were really in the process of creating this, what I would call a modern empire that's created primarily through economics, always with the threat in the background of military intervention or people we call the jackals. So if leaders did not accept my deal, this deal I offered them, then they knew there were these people that stood behind them that had taken out Allende in Cuba and Lumumba in the Congo and Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala. We call these people jackals that either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. So really what I'm saying to these leaders is, hey, in this hand I got a few billion dollars that's going to help you and your friends and your country, and in this hand I got a gun. In case you choose not to go that route. I didn't carry a gun, but he knew, the leader knew, and I knew that there were people behind me that did carry guns.
It sounds very Hollywoodish. I am reminded of that Nicolas Cage movie, I think it's called Lord of War. Was your work a lot less sensational?
Well, you know, movies, like my book to a certain degree, focus on what's exciting. You know, you don't give a lot of camera time or writing time to all the hours that I spent typing up reports, you know, and sitting in boring meetings. There was a lot of that. But there was also the very exciting times when I met with presidents, when I gave them these talks, when my life was threatened, when things went on. But those are a small percentage of the actual experience that you have. But those are the ones that make the movies, and those are the ones that you write about in books because that's what people want to read about. And they happen. They happen. They just—it's not like your life is constantly filled with those moments. Although when I was overseas, when I was working in Panama or Indonesia, there was a lot of that time that was very exciting and very interesting, and meeting with fascinating people and being in situations that were very interesting.
How were you actually recruited for this kind of work?
Well, I was. So before I joined the Peace Corps, I was interviewed by the National Security Agency in the United States. And I was married at the time, and my wife's father was very high up in the U.S. government, and his best friend was very high up in the National Security Agency. That was another possibility of a draft deferment. And I went through some very extensive interviews, including a lot of time on a lie detector, and was offered a job with the National Security Agency, basically as a trainee. But I was ready to accept that, but it was like my last month or so in business school, and I happened to walk by a room where a Peace Corps recruiter was speaking, and it really caught my interest. And I'd always wanted to go to the Amazon. I'd always been interested in indigenous cultures. I grew up in New England. My family goes back to the 1600s in New England. I was always really interested in the Indians in the United States and how they lived with the land. And I knew there was one place in the world where they still lived like that, and that was the Amazon. And so I talked to this Peace Corps recruiter afterwards and said, "Hey, you know, if I applied for the Peace Corps and asked for the Amazon, do you think I'd get it?" He kind of looks at me like, "Are you crazy?" "Yeah, you'd get it because nobody wants to go there. We need people there." So I did. I applied for the Peace Corps and got it. And I told this man who was a friend of my wife's father, who'd gone out of his way to get me recruited into the NSA. I told him about this, and I said, "What do you think I should do?" I called him Uncle Frank. He was that close to our family. And he said, "Well, go to the Peace Corps," because he said, "You'll get great training. You'll learn survival techniques. You'll learn another language. You'll learn how to survive in another culture. You'll be a lot more valuable to us. And when you get out, you can come and work for us then." But he said, "You know, you may not actually work for the National Security Agency. You may work for a big corporation that has close ties with the NSA." And that's exactly what I ended up doing.
And did you know that you were going to con governments?
Yeah, so I was trained by this woman named Claudine Martin, or Martine in Spanish. And she was amazing. She told me everything. She taught me a lot. She was very smart and very seductive, and she was an amazing teacher. But what the line that I got, in which I believed, was that you're really going to be helping these countries, John. You're going to convince them to take these huge loans. But we can show that when these countries build these big infrastructure projects, that gross domestic product increases. And, you know, I'd seen these models in business school, and she showed me more. The World Bank has all kinds of evidence that this process of getting countries to take these huge loans and hiring our companies to build infrastructure increases their GDP. It does. And so for the first 7 years or so out of the 10 that I had this job, I thought I was doing the right thing. And then Omar Torrijos, who was the head of state of Panama, and several other people really read me the Riot Act and said, "You know, yes, you're increasing GDP, but GDP does not measure the prosperity of our people. It measures how well a few rich people in the big corporations are doing, including your corporations." So that had not occurred to me. I thought GDP was a good measure of prosperity. It is not. It is truly a measure of how well the rich are doing. So for the first 7 years, I thought I was doing the right thing. After that, when I realized what I was doing was wrong, I didn't want to admit it. I didn't want to know the truth. And I think this goes to the heart of the matter, Jeremy, of so many people today are in these businesses where they've convinced themselves, even though they may in their hearts know it otherwise, that they're doing the right thing because, well, in my case, I was making a lot of money. I'd grown up the son of a relatively poor teacher in rural New Hampshire, and now I'm traveling first class around the world, flying first class, staying in the best hotels, eating in the finest restaurants, wining and dining with presidents and beautiful women and things that I could only have dreamed about before, you know? So I'm living the American dream, and I'm doing something that I'm understanding is not right, but I don't want to admit it. For the next 3 years, I lived this life of compromise. You know, I was really leading at least two lives, at least several lives. And as I said at the beginning, I didn't realize that. I thought I was continuing doing what I'd been doing in the Peace Corps, which I thought was helping people, but doing it on a much larger scale. And yeah, once I realized that, it was very, very tough because there was all kind of pressure put on me not to get out. And at the same time, I was getting all these perks.
Excuse the pun.
Yeah, sure.
Your first assignment, if memory serves, was Indonesia. Take me through that and explain how that hit went down.
Oh my God, that was strange because I didn't really know what I was doing. This woman Claudine had trained me in Boston, and then off I go to Indonesia. And Indonesia at the time was critical to U.S. foreign policy. So, but at that time, this is the early 70s, we knew we'd lost the war in Vietnam, basically. You know, we were still trying to convince people that we were winning, but the government knew. The NSA knew. We all knew. And there was a belief in the domino effect that if Indonesia went communist, then, if Vietnam went communist, then all of Southeast Asia would go communist, and Indonesia would be the linchpin in that. Indonesia was considered to have a tremendous amount of oil. It had the largest Muslim population of any country in the world at the time. I think it still does, I'm not sure. And it's located in a critical trading route, you know, where the big ships go through the straits along there. In Sumatra. And so Indonesia was considered to be extremely important. And the president of Indonesia, Suharto, was, flirting with Russia, flirting with the Soviet Union, flirting with China, and flirting with the United States. And we were determined to bring him around to our side. So my job was critical, was to go in and convince his government to take these huge loans and hire us to build a big electrification project that would electrify the whole island of Java, which is extensive. It's a heavy, heavy population. It's a big island. There's east, west, and central Java. And at the same time, put the country deep into debt to us. And so there I was supposedly to do this job, and I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I'm a young guy out of the jungles of Ecuador with a very very short background in economics from college and a little training. And it was funny, you know, because I got there and I'm going to be interviewing top ministers in the government, and I was sitting in the bar of the Hotel Indonesia, Intercontinental Hotel, the best hotel in the country, and where I was staying, which was shocking to me that I could live this life. And I'm sitting talking to what's called an old Asian hand, a guy who's been around a long time, doing kind of what I was doing. And I'm like, I don't know, how when I go in and interview these people, I don't know, I probably won't even understand half the things they say. And he said, well, if you don't understand what one of these guys is saying, just kind of rub your chin and roll your eyes and look very wise and say, yes. Could you go into that in a little bit more detail? I'm very interested in what you have to say. Yes. So I perfected this. It's an acting job. And I get very good at it, actually. You know, basically, I hesitate to say this, but the fact of the matter is my job was to be a con man. getting a hitman. And then I ended up hiring a lot of people, people with MBAs and PhDs and econometrics and finance and so on. So my job was to get them to develop econometric models and other studies that would prove that, you know, if this country accepted these huge loans from us, and invested in these infrastructure projects, their GDP would take off. And then these presidents could use that to convince their people that they were doing a good job. They were taking on these loans for good reasons. At the same time, the president and his cronies would end up making a lot of money through basically under-the-table deals that we struck with them, usually not illegal. But for example, in Indonesia, I would offer these heads of ministries, I say, hey, you know, and if you hire our company, we're going to make sure that your children and your friends' children get scholarships to some of the best universities in Boston. We're located in Boston. There's a lot of good colleges and universities. We'll get you full scholarships, we'll pay for the scholarships. And we'll give you your kids jobs during Christmas vacation and summers. And when they get out of school, they get a job with us if they want it. Now, that's worth a tremendous amount to people in these countries. But it was totally legal. In fact, we'd go to the Boston Globe and say, hey, last year we invested $1 million in scholarships for kids in these poor countries. We didn't mention that the scholarships went to families that didn't need scholarships. They were already wealthy. So these were bribes, but totally legal, totally legal. We were a very careful company to follow the rules of non-corruption and non-bribery, but we were bribing people, just doing it legally.
The company, if I'm correct, was Chaz T. Main, is that right?
Correct, yes.
What exactly was the firm? It's consulting of some sort.
Yeah, we call ourselves an engineering consulting firm. I was head of the economics department. We had an economics department, but our main goal was to design and manage big construction projects. But first we had to get them financed. We had to get them accepted. That was my job. And we never did actual construction, and we prided ourselves on that we had no conflict of interest. Bechtel did the construction, or Brown and Root, or Stone and Webster, or one of the big construction companies. We just went in and struck the deals. We cut the deals. And we did, our engineers did the design and often the management of the projects, but somebody else did the heavy construction. And we were about 2,000 professional people, and then a lot of administrative and secretarial people that supported that effort. And about 5% of the company were the owners, what we call, it's like a partnership, a closely held corporation. I ended up being one of those 5%. As it turned out, a few years after I left, the company made some huge mistakes. They bought construction companies, which was a huge mistake, which they'd always prided themselves on not doing. Basically went into bankruptcy, sold themselves to Shaw Engineering, and I think that's been sold to another company since. The name Charles T. Main went out of existence around 1985. But the company had been around for 100 years. It was a very old and very highly respected company that in the end made some very poor management decisions and shot itself in the foot, basically.
Just to be clear, though, it was a private company but was effectively in bed with the U.S. government.
Yeah, that's not uncommon at all, especially not in the international field where there's a close relationship. So my boss, my initial boss, the guy who hired me, was a senior vice president of this company. And he was also in the Army, U.S. Army Reserve, and he was a lay. His job in the reserve was to be as a liaison with the CIA and NSA and other intelligence agencies. So he was coordinating activities between our company and these government entities. And again, none of it was illegal. We gave them information. We traded information. We did things they asked us to do, and they were there to help us if we got into trouble. Which is what they're supposed to do. You know, that's what the embassy is for. That embassy that you have to go to in South Africa, that's highly fortified. Well, its main purpose is not to help individuals like you or me in a country. Its main purpose in most countries is to serve the interests of big corporations. there was a truth behind the fact that investing all that money in infrastructure, building a big electrical system, would fire up the economy, because, you know, industries need electricity. And in those days, when I went in there, there weren't that many big industries, and the big ones that were there usually had their own generating plants. They had huge plants to create their own electricity, self-generation. You know? And that was extremely expensive and unreliable, and it deterred a lot of industry from being developed in Indonesia. So when we built this interconnected system that was very reliable, it encouraged other companies to come in. As it turned out, a lot of those companies in the end were Chinese owned, but it encouraged other companies to come in, encouraged people to expand. So it did increase the GDP, but it did not necessarily increase the prosperity of the people themselves. I don't know, I haven't seen the latest numbers on South Africa, but what I do know is that Africa in general owes China now a lot of money. It used to be the United States, European
high speed trains.
Yeah. And so what's the collateral? It's oil, or now lithium is a big one, cobalt, all kinds of minerals, especially the minerals that are used in high-tech industry today. That's a big one. And so China today, and in my day it was the United States, and still is to a certain degree, can go in and say, hey, you know, we built all these infrastructure systems for you. You're not paying off your loans. You get tremendous debt to us. You've got to sell your resources real cheap to our corporations without environmental or social regulations. And that's what's happening. So it's a form of entrapment.
Yeah, debt slavery.
Yeah, it is debt slavery. And although it may benefit whoever drives on those highways and so forth, you've got a lot of people in the poor sections of your big cities that don't benefit at all from that. In fact, they probably suffer because money is diverted from providing them with social services, with education and healthcare, and perhaps water and sewage. I don't know the details in South Africa, but that's typically the case where yes, it's very impressive. I just came back from Ecuador a couple of weeks ago, where it was a country where I did a lot of work and where I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I did a lot of work as an economic hitman. And the loans that we provided to that country, and recently China has provided, have built magnificent highways, roads, and dams, and all kinds of things. But for the most part, the 80% of the country doesn't benefit from that. The poor people don't benefit very much from those things. The wealthy do, the ones who build the industries. Here's an example, Jeremy. In the United States, three individuals have as much money as half the population. The bottom half economically. Three individuals, three. And you can do a back of the envelope calculation that if those three individuals made 10% on their investments last year, and half the country lost 3%, and the rest of the country remained the same, you'd show a growth in GDP of about 4%, almost 4%. A growth of 4%, where in fact only three individuals made all the money, and half the country suffered, and the rest of the country didn't change. And that's in the United States, where three individuals own as much as half the country. Well, what about in countries where three individuals own as much as 90% of the country, which is often the case in what we call the lower income countries?
What impact did you have on Ecuador?
Well, amongst other things, the president that I was dealing with, Jaime Roldós, democratically elected president, refused to play my game. He was one of the few heads of state that did not go along with this. And he went down in a private plane crash there's a tremendous amount of evidence that would indicate that was not an accident. It was an assassination. There's never been a smoking gun found. Because if you want to kill someone, his personal private plane is a pretty good way to do it, because the smoking gun goes up goes down with the plane, burns up with the explosion. So that was very, very sad for me. That this guy who who I was always worried about him because he was very tough on us. He would not play this game. He said, no, the United States is trying to exploit me. I'm not going to let that happen. I am not going to buy into your deal. And I would tell him, well, look, remember what happened to Allende in Cuba. I mean, in Chile, remember what happened to Arbenz in Guatemala. Remember, remember, remember. And but he stuck to his value system and paid the price.
You were also involved with the Middle East, well, in the Middle East, and you had some relationship, I believe, with Saudi and Saddam, etc. Is that right?
It's a very strong relationship with the Saudis. Yes, we hammered together a deal with the Saudis that was extremely important and has remained important up until very recently.
In what way?
Well, so in the early 70s, the OPEC, the oil-producing countries, launched a huge embargo against the United States because they didn't like the way we had assisted Israel in the war against the Arab nations. And it was devastating to the United States. There were huge lines at gas stations. Our economy was sinking because of this embargo. And it was led by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was the biggest oil producer, and it ran OPEC, essentially. So the U.S. Treasury Department came to me and in my company and said, hey, you know, you can't let this happen again. Do something. And so I go off to Saudi Arabia. The Treasury Department paid us a lot of money to do something. And I go off to Saudi Arabia and realize that we need to put together this deal with the Saudis. And it's a long story with a lot of interesting details of me having to pimp for Saudi princes and all kinds of... All kinds of gory detail. But you know, one of the things I most remember is when I first got to Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest oil company in the country in the world, the garbage system there was a herd of goats that wandered around.
What?
A herd that wandered around the streets of Riyadh eating the garbage. They had no garbage system. And after they signed a contract with us, one of the next contracts, I don't know whether it was the absolute next or what, but it was with waste management to develop a waste system, because it was very embarrassing for the Saudis. Very rich.
Goats.
Flying around in their private jets, and goats are cleaning up their garbage in their capital city. Anyway, it was an experience. Saudi was a very, very backward country at the time with a lot of money. And so we ended up striking this deal with the Saudis that we called SAMA, the Saudi Arabia Money Laundering Affair. And basically what it amounted to is that the Saudis agreed to never buy oil for anything except U.S. dollars. So the dollar
was... The petrodollar.
The petrodollar. Yeah, and at that point it was very important because in 71, Nixon had gone off the gold standard, taken the dollar off the gold standard. So the dollar's floating around out there. It's not sure where it's going to go or who's going to support it. Now we strike a deal that makes it supported by oil, basically, which is very important. And they also agreed that they would invest all of their petrodollars, or most of their petrodollars, in U.S. Treasury bonds. And the interest from those bonds would be used by the U.S. Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, to bring in waste management, to build big cities. And we did. Bechtel ended up building several large cities in the country. In fact, I married a woman whose father was the chief architect at Bechtel, and he was in charge of this, which was another interesting aspect. But so the deal was... Only use dollars to buy oil, invest the petrodollars back in U.S. treasuries, use the interest, which has amounted to trillions of dollars, to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, and never allow the price of oil to go higher than the oil companies were willing to agree to. And in exchange, we agreed to protect the House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, to keep them in power. And that deal has been maintained. You know, we all know that when Saddam Hussein attacked Kuwait and he was threatening Saudi Arabia, we immediately sent in troops under the first Bush presidency. That was to protect Saudi Arabia as much as Kuwait. And, you know, after 9/11, when no planes were flying in the United States, oh, well, there were a few planes flying, and they were taking the royal Saudis out of the United States, back to Saudi Arabia. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, we've maintained this. It's now seems to be sort of falling apart. And part of the reason is that the Saudis recognize that China's the new emerging superpower. And so they're not going to ruin their relationship with China simply because they got a deal that was put together back in the early 70s with the United States. And they've also been pretty pissed off at the United States because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that they see. We in the United States talk about how anti-Muslim the Chinese are because of the Uyghurs and so forth. And that's certainly true. But a lot of the world looks at it as we're very anti-Muslim because of the devastation that we've caused in Iraq and Afghanistan and our support of Israel. So the Saudis are not real happy with us right now, and they are increasingly turning to China.
But Saudi Arabia is still very pro-American.
You think?
Is that, oh, okay. Is that becoming debatable?
It really is. I mean, it's just one thing to talk a certain line. It's another thing to behave and act accordingly.
Right.
And I think the Saudi diplomats now are very worldly. they're being very careful, and they're trying to court both arenas, the Chinese arena and the American, European arena. They're working hard to keep both of them happy.
John, you mentioned earlier about the attempts to control or to restrict the spread of communism. For the most part, that doesn't sound like such a terrible idea.
Well, it depends on what you mean by communism. So, for example, in during my time in the 70s as an economic hitman, there was what we call the red tide of communism was taking over Latin America. That was a bunch of bull. I mean, it was a bunch of crap. It wasn't true at all. The idea being that Cuba was a satellite puppet of the Soviet Union and was organizing all these revolutions in Latin America. Cuba was a poor country despite some support it got from Soviets. They didn't get very much support. And, you know, its most notable exporter of revolution was Che Guevara, who had what, two dozen idealists who hardly knew how to carry a gun in the jungles of Bolivia and were wiped out very, very quickly by Felix Rodriguez, who was a CIA asset and a guy I personally knew. So there really was no red tide of communism. There was a movement of socialism. Allende was a socialist, and Arbenz was a socialist, and others were socialists, but they were not pro-Soviet at all. And we painted them that way. Jaime Roldós, the president who went down in the plane crash in Ecuador, was a socialist and a nationalist. He wanted the U.S. oil companies to pay a fair share of their profits back to Ecuador. That's not unreasonable. That's not Soviet communism, you know? But we spread this word. There was a huge propaganda campaign in the United States to paint these people as puppets of the Soviet Union, which was just not true. So had they been puppets of the Soviet Union, had they been true Soviet communists in our hemisphere, I would agree with you. That should be stopped. But that was not the case. These were nationalists who were sick of being exploited by our corporations and the Monroe Doctrine, the policy that the United States embraces, that we have the right to basically manage this whole hemisphere. And Latin Americans despise that idea. They don't like us build military bases on their soil. Who does? They want a foreign power on their soil. So, you know, we were not really fighting communism. What we were doing was implementing policies that gave our corporations tremendous power and influence and the ability to control the resources of these parts of the world that we claimed were turning to communism, which they really weren't. In the case of Indonesia, yes, the president of Indonesia was flirting with the Soviets and with the Chinese and with the Americans. In other words, he was being a good diplomat. You know, he was hedging his bets. He was working on all sides to see where he could get the best deal.
And this happened in Panama too.
Yeah, well, Panama was a very different case in some respects because the president of Panama, Omar Torrijos, who became a good friend, you know, Omar was an amazing guy. He was very, very popular in Panama. He was a beau vivant. He loved his rum and his cigars and his women and his parties. And yet he was also a very good president. And he was determined to get the Panama Canal back in the hands of the Panamanians. He said, you know, this swath of I think about 50-mile long area that's 20 miles wide in Panama, runs through the middle of Panama, and the United States claims it as U.S. territory. It was an insult. And he said, you know, we should get the canal back. You guys have had it for 100 years now. You've had it for long enough to you know, pay yourselves back. And now it's our turn. And he ended up striking a deal with Jimmy Carter that did get the canal back in his hands. But in the process, he became a hero throughout Latin America and in Africa and many other parts of the world because he was this David, president of a little tiny country. Panama had no economy compared to the United States, you know, and no military, really. And he stood up to the Goliath, David standing up to Goliath, and he became a symbol. And the United States hated that. And he wouldn't back down. And he wouldn't accept my deals either. At one point, he takes me, I'm on this private yacht that a friend of his had lent him. He didn't own any yachts, but somebody had lent it to him on this beautiful yacht. And we're drinking, I don't know, margaritas or something. And we're surrounded by these gorgeous young women in very small bikinis. Yeah, we're smoking cigars, and this is coffee, but that wasn't coffee. And Omar says to me, John, you know what you're doing is wrong. And he was one of the ones that really told me this about GDP and so forth. He says, what you're doing is wrong. Why don't you come and work for me? You'll make a lot less money, but you'll have a lot more fun. Waves his hand around these bikini-clad ladies, and he said, "You'll have a lot more fun, and you'll feel good about what you're doing." Less than 3 months after Jaime Roldós's private plane went down, Omar Torrijos's private plane went down, almost exactly the same circumstances, and the same suspicion that's totally reigned in most of Latin America believes, the United States denies it, but that these were both assassinations. That's the inference. And I have every reason to believe that these were assassinations, though I have no proof. I have no proof.
You were dancing around on very high levels. Did you ever feel like your life was in danger?
Yeah. Sure. Probably not in as much danger as it would have been if I'd gone to Vietnam. I did not dwell on that danger at all because I was a go-between. You know, I was the con artist. The CIA wasn't going to kill me. I was working for them. And the government of these countries wasn't going to kill me because I was trying to bring them around to doing something, but I wasn't using any force.
You were playing within the law.
Yeah, and I was playing within the law. So I never felt any real serious danger until I quit and got ready to write the book. And then I got threats against my life.
By who?
Well, so after I quit, I decided to write about what I'd done. And I contacted other economic hitmen, other guys that had jobs like me, and the jackals. I knew some of these assassins. And I wanted to include their stories in the book. And almost immediately, I got anonymous phone calls threatening my life and that of my infant daughter. And I took the matter seriously. I knew what these people could do. And at the same time, when I got invited out to dinner by the president of Stone & Webster Engineering Corporation, big, big engineering company, one of the companies we'd worked with in Boston, still a big company. And this guy, the president of this company, takes me out to dinner and he says, "Hey, John, you know, you've got a great resume. You just quit Charles T. Maine. You were chief economist. You had 50 people working for you. You had a great resume. We'd like to use it in our proposals. You won't have to do much work for us. We might ask you to fly in our private jet down to Rio de Janeiro a couple of times and have dinner with some important people there or something like this. But you really don't have to do very much. Just let us use your resume. And I'm prepared tomorrow morning to write you a check for $500,000. Now, Jeremy, this was in the late 80s.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money today, but it was a lot more money back then. So I'm getting the same strategy implemented against me as I'd been using. I'm being offered all this money, $500,000. And he said, that's a consultant's retainer. We'll also pay you a consultant's fee every month. This is just the retainer. And so I'm being offered this, and I'm also being offered a gun. You know, the telephone threats of killing me and my daughter.
Gee. Well, yeah. I mean, what did you do?
What would you do? I took the money, and you know, my defense, I didn't go out and buy fast cars or yachts or big houses. I put the money into going back to the Amazon where I'd been a Peace Corps volunteer and telling the people there, "I want to help you save your forests." And so I ended up forming a nonprofit, Dream Change, and later Pachamama Alliance. And I've devoted the rest of my life to trying to turn the system around. What we really created was something we call a death economy. That's what I was involved in creating, an economic system that's built on maximizing short-term profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs, and that's really driving itself toward extinction through its overconsumption of resources and its pollution of the planet. And I recognize that. So that got me into devoting my life to writing about a life economy, being a proponent of an economic system that pays people to clean up pollution, you know, corral all the plastics that's floating around in the oceans and recycle it, you know, regenerate destroyed environments. Create new technologies that go way beyond solar and wind as far as producing energy from the wind or water or whatever. There's all kinds of things that we can do to create an economic system that's goal is long-term benefits for all life. Some short-term profits for business, because you got to make profits to survive, but you don't have to maximize them. You can make some profits, you know, 3%, 4% on your investment. That's great. And then invest the rest into making a better future for our children and grandchildren. So, you know, really after I went through this whole experience, it convinced me that what my job is to use what I know about this system to turn it around.
Redemption.
Yeah, redemption, you can say that, and I'm not sure there's any such thing as redemption in this case. I did what I did. It's been done. But now I'm determined to do something different. I have a daughter and I have a grandson, and you know, I am very committed to making the world a better place for them and all their brothers and sisters across the planet.
But why the Amazon?
Well, because that's where I was a Peace Corps volunteer and know it well. And it's also, the Amazon rainforest is about the same size as the continental United States. It's huge, and it's being attacked by mining and oil companies. And today, the Chinese are playing a large role. And it is where so much of our oxygen and fresh water originate. It's an extremely important biosphere for our entire planet. It needs to be protected, but it is also a microcosm. So I focus on a globe transforming the global death economy that's pervasive that China's doing. My most recent book, the third edition of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, the third in the trilogy, is about China's economic hitman and how they're doing the same thing we did, even more effectively than we did it. And that's got to stop. I mean, we've got to put an end to this death economy, regardless of whether it's being driven by the United States or China or whoever.
How?
by creating a life economy, which we're in the process of doing. You know, in recent years, there's been a large emphasis on ecological civilization, on conscious capitalism, on benefit corporations, B corporations, on solar and wind power, and coming up with new technologies that don't ravage the environment, that recycle existing copper instead of mining for copper. So we're moving in that direction. I think as I travel around the world speaking at various venues, and as I mentioned, I just came back from Latin America. I see the people all over the world, this program we're doing, people are conscious. They're waking up. They're wanting to hear this information. There's a consciousness revolution that understands that the system we've created is failing us. It can't continue. It just can't continue. And that's not to say that it hasn't done great things. It has. We've created incredible medicine and science and technology and music and art and all kinds of things, but it's gone too far. And now we need to turn it around and create this life economy. And people are waking up to that all over the world, which I think gives us great hope. At the same time, there's a pushback by the status quo that doesn't want to see change. That's represented, you know, by the various political leaders, Trump being a good example in the United States of someone who's pushing back against that. And it's true around the world. Putin in Russia is pushing back. Xi in China is pushing back against that. So there's a pushback. But that always happens during a revolution. And this is a revolution in consciousness, that there's always pushback. And, you know, Jeremy, I've got to say, I've been a martial artist most of my life. And I know that if I'm up against a person who's bigger and stronger than me, I shouldn't try to overpower him. I have to use his energy against him. And that's how I look at, like, when you get pushback from the status quo, you don't try to stop the status quo. You try to use their energy and turn it around and turn it against them. You take energy from their energy. I feel blessed to have had the life I've had and to have come through it. I only did that really bad stuff for 10 years. I'm about to turn 80. So that's a pretty small part of my Yes, in January, I feel younger. I'm pretty active, but it's been exciting. And you know, the dark side was about 10 years, and I think actually my life is an example of how we can turn ourselves around. As I see it, I totally turned myself around. I learned from my mistakes. And now I'm doing everything I can to use what I've learned in that job to create something better, to be the economic hitman in favor of a life economy. Yes, more now than ever. And you know, in my day, we were kind of generic. We were just promoting capitalism, U.S. form of capitalism. Today, every major corporation has its form of economic hitman. So all the international corporations have guys that do this. And an example would be that, you know, if a company decides it needs to build a new manufacturing facility, it might send its economic hitman to Indonesia and Vietnam and the Philippines and say, hey, you know, which one of you will give us the better deal? Which one of you will give us a tax holiday? We don't have to pay any taxes. And give us cheap labor with few environmental restrictions. And they put a lot of pressure on these countries to give them a really good deal so that they can build their plant in that country. And those are economic hitmen that every major international corporation has its own form of economic hitmen. Now, that was not true in my day. These corporations were not playing that kind of a game for the most part. So, yeah, there's a lot. And we were all being hit on another level, too. The student debt and healthcare debt, at least in the United States, and credit card debt. So, in a way, the system that I helped to develop back in the 70s has now become pervasive in many aspects of our lives.
No conversation with me is complete without making a reference to my continent, which is Africa. Where do you see Africa going?
Well, it's striking to me that here Africa is the wealthiest continent in the world, based on resources, and the poorest in the world based on per capita income. It also has the youngest population in the world. I think the average age is something like 19. And the Chinese really recognize this because they've got a growing, an aging population. They see Africa as an incredible resource for them. I think, I would encourage the African countries, or at least a group of them, to come together and really form an alliance that insists on being treated better by outside influences. And so these resources that exist, all lithium, for example, today, which has become so important in the tech industry, insist that the lithium mines be owned by the company, the countries, and that the people get a share of the profits, and the people working in those mines get well paid and get health care and retirement insurance, get taken care of. And I don't think any one country can do that very successfully. But if you form alliances, and I would say the same for Latin America, if African countries can form alliances, or if the major countries that have the biggest amounts of resources come together and all insist that yes, we need technical help. We don't have the capability to develop these mining operations ourselves right now. But you come in and help us develop our own mining operations, and for the next 5 or 10 years, you can benefit from that. But over time, you got to work yourselves out of this and give us and be very, very insistent on that. But do it as a collective. I think it's very difficult for one country to take that stand. And I like to encourage people. You know, I say you can ask yourself 5 questions. Whatever you do in life, ask yourself. Do we have time to go into those? I don't know. We're at the end.
Yes, by all means. No, please do.
So first question is, what do I most want to do for the rest of my life? What will bring me the greatest satisfaction? And I would say, I want to write. I love to write. Okay. And I have a friend who's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. He's a carpenter. He says, I want to work with my hands and wood. The second question is, how do I do this in a way that helps transform the death economy to a life economy? Every one of us can ask these questions. And I would say, as a writer, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to try to inspire people to get involved in that, which is what I do. And my carpenter friend would say, I'm only going to use sustainable material, sustainable wood, and I'm going to replant a tree for every tree that my wood cuts down. And the third question is, okay, so what's stopping you from doing that? And as a writer, I might say, well, I know to be a successful writer, I've got to write for at least 2 hours every day. I just don't have time. And my carpenter friend might say, well, my clients don't want to pay the extra price for sustainable woods or to get me to replant trees. And so the fourth question is, when you touch that jaguar, which means when you confront your shortcomings, when you confront whatever it is that's blocking you, if you let whatever is blocking you block you, if you run from it, if you're in denial, if you don't face it, it chases you. But if you go out, if you admit to it, if you really look at it, you touch it. And what happens when you touch it? How does it change your perception? And when we change perception, we change our actions. And when we change our actions, we change our reality. So I would say as a writer, when I touch that jaguar, it says, you could turn off the television for 2 hours every night and write. Or you could get up a little earlier every day and write. And my carpenter friend would say, well, I can tell my clients that their extra price is not a cost, it's an investment in the future. When they pay for me to use sustainable materials, they're investing in their children's future. And then the fifth question is, what's the next step? What actions do I take immediately? Where do I go with this? When I touch that jaguar, what happens next? I got a tail in the face. So I think, regardless of whether you're a teacher or a student, a parent or a child, a plumber, or whatever you are, you can ask yourself these questions. What do I most want to do for the rest of my life, and how do I do this in a way that helps transform the death economy to a life economy? What's stopping me? And when I confront which is stopping me and really look at it, how do I change my perception? And then what actions do I take? And I think we can all ask ourselves that question. But it all revolves around, the most important part of it is, how do I do it in a way that helps transform the death economy to a life economy? If every one of us is driven by doing what we most want to do in a way that transforms the death economy to a life economy, we'll get there. And I see that happening more and more and more. You know, I look at the young people today. I have a 16-year-old grandson who lives 10 minutes from me, and I get together with him pretty frequently. And, you know, I think that, and I teach, I speak at a lot of high schools and universities and colleges, and I get the impression that younger people really, they're not driven by the same thing I was. I was told that, hey, get a good education, get a good job, you'll keep your job for most of your life, and you'll get a good retirement. Well, they don't believe that anymore. It's not happening anymore. And so they know that they've got to devote themselves to doing what they really want to do. And they understand that the world is threatened and that it's their responsibility to take care of the messes that my generation created. And the best I can do is to be as good a mentor as I can and say, hey, the lessons I learned from creating this mess, I want to help you understand them so you don't repeat it and you can get beyond it. So I have a lot of hope for the future generations here and all over the world, including in China. I recently taught in China, not all that recently, but not too long ago in China at an MBA program there. And I was deeply impressed by the commitment of the young people there to make a better world. They know what it's like to live with terrible pollution. They don't want it for their kids.
If I had to ask you what your most memorable moment was as an economic hitman, what was it?
I think it was so many. But I guess I'd have to say it was one of the last moments I had as an economic hitman, which I was on vacation. And I rented a small sailboat in the Virgin Islands in the Caribbean and anchored off St. John Island. And just before sunset, I rowed the dinghy ashore and I climbed up this hill to an old sugarcane plantation, the ruins. It was beautiful, bougainvillea, beautiful flowers. I'm sitting there, I've got a couple of beers, and I'm looking out at the sun setting over the Caribbean. It seems idyllic. And then I'm struck by the fact that this sugarcane plantation was built on the bones of thousands of slaves. It's beautiful, but it's built on the bones of thousands of slaves. And then I had to see how the whole hemisphere, the Americas, all of the Americas are built on the bones of millions of slaves from many different parts of the world, including our own indigenous people. And then I had to admit that I too was a slaver. I was enslaving people in debt, not physical chains, but debt. In that moment, I decided I'll never do this again. And I was really, really angry at myself. I grabbed a big stick that was up there, and I slammed it against the tree. I broke it. I get really angry. And I went back a couple of days later to Boston to the president of my company, my boss, and quit.
When was this? What year?
1980. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that was perhaps the most memorable because it was such a decisive moment.
Your book has sold millions of copies and has been translated in so many languages, but for the handful of people that don't know where to get it, how can they get it?
Well, yeah, you should be able to buy it anywhere where books are sold in one of those languages. I don't know, you know.
Amazon. Excuse the pun.
You can certainly get it online. But I'd suggest to people to go to my website, johnperkins.org. And incidentally, I still take small groups of people, not more than 15, deep into the Amazon to get to meet the people I write about, and also to the Mayan people of Guatemala. I've got a trip coming up in January to the Amazon, which is sold out now, but another one in March to the Mayan people of Guatemala, which actually is my favorite trip. So I'd love to see some of your people join me. And also, please come. And also, please put your name in the little box so you get my newsletter that comes out. It's short and pithy, absolutely brilliant. Well, it's fun. It comes out only once a month, and it'll have information about where I'm speaking or trips and so forth, so people can follow where I'm going to be if they want to actually meet me in person. Just put your email address in that little box.
John Perkins, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
My pleasure. Thanks for all that you do, Jeremy, and keep up your great work.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.